tonight on Arena. Emer Walsh on representing Ireland at the 60th Venice Biennale, and we review Emma Donoghue's Pull of the Stars at the Gate Theatre. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The visual world is building up to its biannual get-together in the Pearl of the Adriatic as Venice prepares for its 60th Biennale. Artists from all over the world represent their countries in the various national pavilions, which are either set in the Giardini, where foreign pavilions pepper the grounds, or in the monstrous old shipbuilding complex called the Arsenale. All around the city, one can explore even more art than is usually on offer in haunts such as the Palace of the Doge or the home of Peggy Guggenheim. In the British Pavilion, visitors can expect to see the work of video artist John Okomfra. And in the US Pavilion, it presents their very first Indigenous artist, Jeffrey Gibson, exploring colonial legacy, which will undoubtedly be among the subjects there. So too in the work of the artist representing Ireland in the Irish Pavilion in the Arsenale. Romantic Ireland is the title of Emer Walsh's entry in the pavilion. Walsh will construct a rammed earth building with video screens presenting images of various Irish archetypes dressed in traditional garb, counterpointed with the deviant skin-tight masks that they wear. Delighted to be joined from Venice this evening by Emer Walsh. I suppose for many people, even the sound of the word Venice will give thoughts of city breaks and wonderful ramblings and getting lost around the canals and streets of Venice. What kind of a place is it like to work in, and specifically to work in as part of the Biennale, Emer?
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me. It's an extremely beautiful place to work in, and also a very complex place logistically, because of course all of the roads, where you would have roads, you've got canals. Mm. So everything has to come by boat. So if you want to bring something here, it has to come across the water and through canal systems and be loaded and unloaded onto various sizes of containers as they wind their way through the narrow bodies of water that runs through it. So in that way, certainly presents its own kinds of challenges because it's an island. But in another way, I mean, how could you ask for a more beautiful backdrop or context for your work? We're in the Arsenale space, and it is just a really, really amazing building. The Irish Pavilion's been in the same space for a good few years now, in that last room, and there's beautiful big high ceilings and crumbling walls, and it's amazing. And as you pass through each of the different national pavilions, you just kind of wind your way all the way down, and there's some really there's some works this year that really contend with the scale of the space. You can really go up.
Well, I can hear the excitement and the stimulation that the stimulus that the location itself has been to you. Romantic Ireland, Romantic Ireland, the title of the work that you're presenting, Emer. Obviously, for most people, you hear that phrase, the next thing you're going to say is dead and gone. It's with O'Leary in the grave. That's a fairly potent title to choose. Is it dead and gone, Romantic Ireland? Or are you hoping to reinvigorate it?
Yeah, I guess I'm probably thinking about the title as, let's say, maybe a perversion of Yeats. Mm. I guess there's two main things I'm thinking about with the title. One is, for a good few years now, I've been thinking about how I like Irish history, social history, land history, and the housing situation especially impacts our romantic and personal lives. And the story in the multi-channel video work that I've made, it's trying to be a romantic story. So it starts with a proposal scene. There's all of these almost romantic moments, but they're always disrupted. Like, you're trying to propose and then the landlord walks in and he's stolen your engagement ring, and history kind of sweeps in and scuppers it. And the other thing that I was thinking about with this title is actually the Italian connection. Mm. Because I guess romantic in the literal sense. During the campaign for Home Rule in Ireland, you'd hear the slogan, Home Rule is Rome Rule. And obviously we had to reject that slogan. It was a call for the imperialist status quo to remain. But in a certain sense, Ireland is romantic. You know, we fought for the freedom to practice Roman Catholicism and Italian spin on Christianity. And then, yeah, something I learned during the course of researching this, and I learned it from the historian Dr. Lisa Godson, was that after the famine in Ireland, Rome sent missionaries to Ireland because we were doing mass wrong.
So we got ourselves corrected by the missionaries that came here.
It sounded like it used to be like we were doing kind of like, it was more like the nativity play.
So we were taught how to do mass properly post famine times. The other very interesting thing that you're doing here, and I find this, I suppose there's an added layer of difficulty in what you're doing, given that it is in Venice, but it's a video installation. But you're talking about rammed earth building. And now, explain what you mean by that, first of all.
Yes. So actually, this comes from in 2021, I was very lucky to meet Harrison Gardner, RTE's own Harrison Gardner, actually. And he brought me on a building course. And it was really amazing. It was like you could go from not knowing how to use a drill all the way to constructing a timber frame house with a concrete floor and installing roofing and everything. But one of the things that he taught, and it wasn't because he thought we'd use it, but he thought it was important for us to know about the history, was cob, which is a vernacular kind of building that a lot of houses were made out of in Ireland, which is a mix of sand and straw and earth. So very, very local. You just dig the materials out of the ground beside you. And the things that were so interesting about that to me was, one is it's very, very labor intensive. You need to get the whole community together to build one person's house. So it kind of points back to a time where there was kind of just a different social organization and the idea of the mehel, where people would come together to kind of support each other. And you know that when your turn came around, somebody would come and help you.
Yeah, because you had helped them, or alternatively, you would help somebody else in the future.
Exactly. There was a kind of a collectivized labor practice around building. And it also must have created a different relationship with
the buildings themselves.
Yeah, exactly. But then the other thing that was amazing about discovering this form of building is there's iterations of building with earth all around the world. And some places it's called adobe, some places it's called pisé, and rammed earth is another form. So basically we found builders, Venetian builders, who had experience with rammed earth. And you have to work with local people because everybody has their own expertise on the local clay and what kind of mix to make. So this great gang called Ribianale, they build here, and of course they had a lot of the information about all those logistical things. And one of the really special things they do is every year for the Biennale, of course, a lot of waste material is created when the install comes down, but they recycle the install materials. They hold on to them because they know, well, this is going to be useful later. This can't go in the bin. It's a beautiful new television, you know. And in our case, we were able to recycle the materials from the earth from the Brazil pavilion last year, has gotten all broken down and then mixed up again and then compacted. But the technique for earth for this kind of rammed earth is different than the style. The cob style was an additive, like modeling with clay, more like. But with rammed earth, you make a form work as if you're pouring concrete, but then you tamp the clay in, or the mix of clay and pebbles and sand.
Well, like, I can hear from that description just how labor intensive it actually is and was. And it sounds as if what you're describing there is a kind of an artist's mell in Venice, where
it certainly is. Yes, and we did. We were in the door on the 1st of March. I think we were the first country in because we had so much. You know, there's drying time. It's very, very labor intensive, and it, in a way, it doesn't. What I'm interested in about it is it doesn't suit the in and out style. It's not disposable. It's not super fast. You have to kind of commit to it. And I'm really excited because in 2025, it'll tour Ireland and we'll get to work with local experts all around the country to do different iterations of
versions of cob,
most likely.
Yeah, with local building materials, literally the clay and stones and whatever from whatever particular part, whatever part of the country you're in. But so you have that built aspect to the installation or to the exhibition. But there are also these video works, one of which involves a number of, should I be calling them characters or are they archetypes? Yeah. Explain these. They're dressed in various different costumes from. I think I heard you describe it from the late 19th century right through until the modern day. That's what they have on their bodies, but on their faces, everybody has these kind of anonymizing masks, almost Spider-Man type masks, you know, where you can't really make out who or what is in behind it. Explain to me the ideas behind that.
Yeah, I guess with the characters, it's interesting. Are they characters? Are they archetypes? I kind of think about it like if you took 150 years of Irish history, put them in a soap opera together and then played it on fast forward. So it's like, it's quite a busy video. It's three channels. So you're watching three kind of angles of the story at the same time. And then, we recorded it with this really amazing team. It's all filmed on phones, so we're passing them back and forth between each other. And then, I worked with the costume designer, Amy Egan, from the neck down. I guess we kind of, there's a late 19th century tenant farmer. There's an early 20th century businessman and his housewife. And then there's a late 20th century solicitor type, and then I play the 21st century landlord, single male, and I guess we were kind of that kind of neck down costume. I suppose is trying to represent what politically gets kind of constructed as the ordinary decent person, like the kind of regular citizen. And then from the neck up, they have these olive green latex skin tight face masks that are kind of associated with deviancy or criminality, or there's a kind of militaristic look to the green.
Kind of frightening look to them as well. Frightening and alienating.
They are. Yeah, they freeze your face, so you can't really make an expression. It was tough to film with them, but everybody was a trooper. They had no shoes on and they had these face masks on.
Everybody was barefooted. And as you say, I mean, this is as well had an element of metal to it because it was filmed by, if at some point you might have been in inverted commas acting the part of a character, but at another point you could have been with your own phone videoing or taping the person acting opposite you. And from all of those various phone recordings then comes the video work that we see. There's also an operatic element to this. Tell me a little bit about that operatic, because I want to listen to some of the sounds, which I must say are quite beautiful in places.
Yeah, I'm so excited about this. I have no prior experience in opera, and the amazing composer Amanda Feary reached out to me. She'd read some of my writing and she asked if I'd be interested in writing a libretto. And she was thinking about the Éamon de Valera speech, sometimes called On Language and the Irish Nation and sometimes called The Ireland That We Dreamed Of. And I first heard about that speech from the work of Ruth Clinton and Niamh Moriarty, and they have a really good critical analysis of it. I mean, people don't like this speech because it paints a really socially conservative vision of Ireland as what we should aspire to, and
the dancing at the also, crossroads, etc., etc.
Yes, that's and it's got kind of gender norms, and it also makes all of these promises of what we get in exchange for conforming to a particular kind of life. And I guess what affects me very much about it is the breaking of that promise, because it kind of paints a picture of a, you know, a socially conservative but fiscally progressive society. You know, he also promises bright and cozy homesteads dotted through the countryside, and, so and are, respect and care for the elderly.
Are the words that are spoken or sung within the opera itself, and whether we have this clip that we're about to hear, are they words from that De Valera speech, or are the particular words we should be looking out for, or what constitutes the lyrics?
Yeah, so what you get in the libretto is quotations of De Valera. So the singers say, Dev said, and then they contrast that with their experience.
Right.
So Dev says, bright and cozy homesteads, I can't even die in peace. So the subject of the opera is an elderly man is being evicted while he tries to die in peace. And that last piece of dignity is taken from him by his evictors. And so that's why I guess opera was a good format to tell this story, because the sort of devastation and emotional intensity of that, I feel like the singers captured it so amazingly. They're from Four in a Bar.
Yeah, from Four in a Bar are the singer, is the group that are singing here, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's have a listen. Just a little section there from the music from the opera that is part of Emer Walsh's work at this year's Venice Biennale, Romantic Ireland. Beautiful sound, as you said, Emer. And is it throughout the entire opera, is it just the four voices without musical accompaniment? Because that is a very haunting type of sound.
Yes, indeed. I think it's five voices. And they are unaccompanied. Yeah, they do a lot of those like very beautiful kind of vowel
harmonies,
sounds that creates this gorgeous like echoey effect. And in the huge, big, vast room, the sound it's really, really incredible. I'm so lucky to have it as part of the show.
I can imagine that in that big open space that you described with the high ceilings and the crumbling walls. One final thing that I thought was interesting, I mentioned in various other exhibitions and installations that will be part of the Biennale that colonialism is an important aspect. I read in an article that you wrote in Frieze magazine, this was talking about the work in Venice, that Richie Kavanagh's, the famous 1990 hit In Focolella, was a kind of a starting point for you in terms of how you were looking at our own attitude to our native tongue.
Yes. I don't think I could make the work that I make without the precedent that Richie Kavanagh has set. I find him really, really inspiring. Yeah, so I wrote about In Focolella, and I suppose the attitude in the song, and I guess if you repeat listen to it and peel back the layers, you know he's singing from the perspective of a child in the mid 20th century who can't acquire Irish because it's being bet into him, and he's frightened of getting it wrong, he's frightened of trying. It's obviously a comedy song in the sort of novelty genre, but I think it resonated with people because, you know, I suppose that the majority of people in Ireland would have a kind of fraught relationship with the mother tongue, and I think definitely he definitely kind of helped examine my own attitudes.
Well, listen, Emer, lovely to speak with you this evening. Go off now and enjoy your whatever you're doing in Venice for the evening. Probably a lot of work finishing stuff off.
No, we're finished. finished.
Ah, you're finished.
As of today. Oh, finito.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Delighted to report.
Yeah, well, there you go. You're done. Go off and enjoy whatever you do then in Venice when you're finished work on a Friday evening.
Thank you so much, Sean.
And thanks for being with us this evening. That's Emma Walsh, who will represent Ireland at the 60th Venice Biennale, curated was the word I was searching for there, by Sarah Gravu. The Biennale runs from April the 20th to November the 24th. Ireland at Venice 2024 is an initiative of Culture Ireland in partnership with the Arts Council and Dublin City Council, and look forward to that description Emma gave us of the potential touring of that installation to parts of Ireland at some point in the next few years, I would guess. The Pull of the Stars is the new play from Emma Donoghue. It opened at the Gate Theatre on Wednesday. The play is set over 3 days in a makeshift maternity ward during the influenza pandemic that ripped through Europe at the end of the First World War. All-female cast includes Sarah Morris as Nurse Judy Power, who she was in with us, in fact, with Louise Lowe, director, a couple of weeks back. Other members of the cast, Galia Conroy as Bridie Sweeney, and directed, as I said, by Louise Lowe. Helen Meaney was at the opening night. I think you were there in the opening night, Helen, and she's with me now to discuss it. As I said to both Louise Lowe and Sarah Morris on the night they were in, it is kind of mind-boggling that when Emma Donoghue wrote the novel, Pull of the Stars, it was 2019, or she was probably doing it for the couple of years ahead of that. There was no mention of pandemics, there was no mention of COVID, there was no mention of any of that. And yet, by looking back at the Spanish flu, she was talking about precisely the same type of thing a century earlier.
Yes, it really is. It is a fantastic coincidence. Mm. And I suppose the fact that we in the audience have so recently experienced a pandemic, and all of the rumours and misinformation and all of, you know, the instructions about how to be and live in a city.
And fears about who should be, who you would be in contact with, and could you be spread just by being in the same room as somebody, all those things.
All of those
things.
And so it feels, you know, we are very close to it, and it feels very resonant, you know. So, yeah, it just adds that whole, I suppose, a sense of real understanding of what people went through. And of course, they didn't have a vaccine.
Yeah.
So it was just such a vicious
And it was Emma Donoghue herself who did this adaptation for the stage.
Yes.
So give us our setup. We're in a maternity hospital in Dublin.
We're in a maternity hospital in 1918, during the outbreak of this terrible so-called Spanish influenza, which really resulted in sudden fever and very, very short-lived suffering and then death. And it was particularly hard, and at least pregnant women were particularly susceptible, because it brought on the fever and that brought on early labour. And so a lot of women died as a result of this premature labour. Mm-hmm. So in this, it's not even a proper ward. It's a makeshift storeroom in the maternity hospital, which is the room for the people with fever. And there are three pregnant women at different stages of their pregnancy,
and they're
shoved in together.
And I think it's interesting, the three, I suppose, through very different stratas of society that Emma Donoghue chooses to give us here, in the three characters of Mary, Della and Honor.
Yes, so the class distinctions are one of the big themes of the play, actually, and just the extraordinary inequality. So there's a middle-class woman who doesn't understand why her baby's not due for a few months, and she doesn't understand why she needs to be in the same room.
Yes, by India Mullen.
That's it. And she's there's a lot of comedy from her squeamishness, not only about being in hospital, but about
sharing. There's a touch of the lady from Rathmines.
Lady from Rathmines, very much.
From the Shadow of a Gunman.
Plough and the Stars. So. And there's a lot of comedy in that. And then the other woman is young and frightened, and she's still a teenager. And
that's Mary Tierney, played by Keira Byrne,
and she really does not know. It's her first pregnancy. She doesn't know what's going to happen. She actually doesn't know what's going to happen physically, and she thinks her baby is going to be born from her belly button. I mean, it's just,
she's very innocent,
uninformed, you know.
Yeah.
And so they're together initially, and then they're joined by a woman who's much in a terrible distress, played by Una Kavanagh, and she's Mrs. Noonan, who's come over from the mother and baby home. She's been pregnant many times. She's with no father in the picture, and she's despised by a lot of the people in this play, and she's. she's really in a sort of feverish sort of delirium, and she's raving, and they all are much more concerned about her once she arrives. But she's, again, from a different... She's even worse off socially, yeah, in that she's despised as an unmarried mother who's been pregnant many times. And there's a figure of a nun, character of a nun, Ruth McKay plays Sister Luke, who is just, you know, so utterly dismissive of the women from the mother and baby homes, or who've come from Magdalen Laundries or the orphanages. It's, you know, it's just this hierarchical view of the world, and that they should live with their shame, live in poverty, die in poverty. Whatever happens to their babies, it doesn't matter. The babies will probably die anyway. It's this very fatalistic
and a kind of an attitude of, well, they brought this on themselves. And caring for them, Sister Luke is one of the carers, let's be said, which is slightly frightening. But caring for them, let's talk first of all about Sarah Morris playing the character of Judy Power, who's kind of the driving force, I think, of the narrative, really.
She's
here.
The sort of heart, she's kind of the emotional heart of the play. So she is a nurse who specialises in midwifery. There wasn't at that time a specific qualification, but she's up against it in this, trying to deal with every single crisis of the women going into labour, the women going into labour prematurely, and all of the things that happen that we see on stage. And she's extremely calm, highly competent. She's a very appealing character, without just bordering on the saintly, perhaps, but not quite.
And coming along to help her is a character called Brady Sweeney, played by Galia Conroy. Let's not go into what nurse training she may or may not have, but she proves herself to be quite competent.
She's a volunteer, and she's come across the road from the Magdalen Laundry. So
herself.
So that's where she grew up. So she is just a completely untrained, raw recruit, and she turns out to be quick-witted and a very capable.
So that the Magdalen Laundries and the mother and baby's home, the mother and baby homes are a big part of the story that's
being told
here.
They really are. So we've got two characters who've come from those institutions, and they've been incarcerated effectively, an adult and I suppose an older teenager. Bridie is really, I think she's under 20 or thereabouts. So there's an emphasis on that whole system of incarceration.
Does that interplay with the narrative, the plot as it's rolling along?
It does.
Because the plot essentially is, are these women going to survive and are the babies going to survive?
Yes, over the course of an extraordinarily hectic 3 days. Yeah. That's all it is. So it's all compressed. And so we have life and death. And so Julia and the doctor, I'll mention in a second, they're dealing with absolute emergency, medical emergencies that involve blood transfusions and actually death.
And does that balance work, that balance of all of those issues that will come up around mother and baby homes and the Magdalen Laundries and the stories that are being told?
Well, there's an awful lot to digest, because we also have the fact that it's the end of the First World War, and we're in that period in Ireland just after the Rising, which is this extraordinary period,
huge historical
revolutionary
moment.
Change. Yeah. So there's a lot to explain. There's a lot of facts that need to be kind of communicated, and it's quite fact heavy, you know, and it's quite didactic at times, I thought, the writing. I suppose it's so difficult to condense a capacious, spacious narrative of a novel into condense that into believable dialogue where characters are talking about huge experiences with a historical backdrop, which they often don't talk about them the way they actually would if they were living through them, because they've got to convey these facts.
Yeah, and that revolutionary spirit of the period is very much there in the character of Dr. Kathleen Lynn, played by Mae Fitzgerald. And this Dr. Kathleen Lynn is a real person, was a real person.
She's a fascinating person. And in a way, her story has come to life a lot during the recent commemorations. And she was with the Citizen Army as a medical director. She was there in 1916. She was imprisoned. And she started keeping diaries. And that's how we know so much about her. She's a free thinker. She's an openly lesbian. She's a radical feminist suffragist, highly educated, and a really quite a formidable character, and Mae Fitzgerald plays her with great dignity and authority and confidence, and that's a very interesting role.
I believe the choreography and the movement within this production is very important, because obviously the the physicality of childbirth to start out with, the physicality of the type of work that the nursing and hospital staff would be involved in as well. Lifting, moving, shifting, washing, cleaning, all of these things. Yeah. How is that portrayed?
Well, I mean, it's really the cast. They put in quite a shift in this ward. I mean, it's like it's really, really full on. It's extremely busy. So it's a cramped space. So they're moving, particularly Sarah Morris. I mean, she never lets up. There's always something. She's mopping brows. She's, you know, moving, you know, well, we won't go into too many of the obstetric details, but it's quite gory and full on visceral. And so it's action packed in a very, I suppose, realistic as you can be with women giving birth on stage.
And do we have any chance, you mean the pull of the stars? And there, I know within the novel there are these scenes where the nurses or some members of the staff go up onto the roof of the hospital.
Yes, they do.
So do we get a sense of that, the city outside?
We do. There's this absolutely lovely central scene between Bridie and Julia, and they're becoming very close and they're attracted to each other, and they go up on the roof overnight and they're looking out of the night sky, and that's really a kind of a respite from all the absolute kind of crisis, you know, medical crises and life and death drama. And that's very, very well directed by Louise Lowe, and we need that at that stage. We need that sense of the wider world.
You need
world.
A chance to breathe yourself.
And it's beautifully designed, actually, as well, that. And so by Alison Cummins. Mm. So that's a lovely moment. But later on, we go back to even Bridie has a lot of... It's as if she's actually read the Ryan report herself.
And yeah, this is Bridie, who's the young helper, the young volunteer.
She's referring to all of the mother and baby homes, the industrial schools, the Magdalen laundries, and in a way that I just don't think that character would speak about them. So we get a little bit too much of Emma Donoghue's research in some of the dialogue. But actually the performances there are gorgeous.
Were they standout performances? I mean, it is very much an ensemble work.
Very much. The cast are all excellent. I mean, I do feel a bit sorry for Ruth McCabe, because Sister Luke is a bit of a cardboard character. I think, the doctor, Kathleen Lynn, we have her diaries and she's very well-rounded, whereas the nun has to be the bad nun, who is almost emblematic of the whole system of incarceration by the Catholic Church. And it's a bit, I think it would have been lovely to see her as a more nuanced person, but we don't. I suppose it's just,
and you think that's in the writing rather than
In the script, yeah. I think there's not a lot a director could do with that. I mean, it's nothing. There's nothing wrong with the performance at all.
Yeah.
It's that there's not enough to go on.
In fact, I get the impression that whatever problems you had perhaps were within that writing aspect, that the balance of message and story, that's where some of the problems
the balance doesn't quite work, and particularly with the humour at the beginning, but it's still a very impassioned play.
Yeah, I was going to say, does the production overcome that?
It's asking the questions that O'Casey is like, well, what have we achieved in 100 years in terms of, we're looking at this appalling social injustice on the stage and we're asking ourselves, well, what has happened since then? And we know that Dr. Lynn, Kathleen Lynn, was really disappointed that independence didn't make women's lives any better. And she was very disillusioned. And we have to ask ourselves about our own health service and other aspects of our society as a result of watching this play. And that's great. It's a stimulus.
Well, if you come off out asking questions like that, I suppose it's done its job in terms of, in inverted commas, message. Does it work overall? Would you recommend it as an evening out?
I'd recommend it with the reservations that I've said, but the performances are really strong, and there's a lovely rapport between the characters, particularly between Dr. Lynn and Sarah, and she encourages her at one point to train to be a doctor, and there's a lovely professional respect.
Yeah.
And that's understated, you know. So yes, there's a lot to enjoy.
A lot to enjoy, says Helen Meaney of The Pull of the Stars by Emma Donoghue, directed by Louise Lowe, which is running at the Gate Theatre through until May the 12th. And so here we are, Friday evening, time to listen to this week's album releases. Two new Irish albums in the mix. Lyra from Cork releases her self-titled debut album, and Dublin-based psych krautrock quartet Melts, who've opened for the likes of Fontaine's DC, give us their second album. It's called Field Theory. And in the middle, we'll be talking about American singer-songwriter Maggie Rogers, who releases her third album, Don't Forget Me, which is all about guess what? Nostalgia for the lost innocence of childhood and adolescence. I'm joined by Zara Hederman and Dave Hanratty, who are both weeping at the thoughts of the lost childhood and adolescence in front of me this evening. We're going to start, however, with Lyra. Why don't we start with what I think is... Oops, no. Why don't we start with what I think is the song that everybody will recognise from Lyra? Falling song there from Lyra, who I spoke to back in, when was that? Was that 2019 when it was used for the final episode of Love Island? And I remember her describing the moment she was sitting at home watching Love Island and she heard her song coming on the television, not even knowing that this was going to happen. She certainly has a voice. I don't think anybody will dispute that. But this is a debut album. I was kind of surprised at that because she has been around the block a few times, Zara.
Yeah, she's been around 8 years and it does feel like she's been around forever because she's kind of omnipresent in Ireland, especially with TV appearances. And she's built up a very strong live reputation. And I think that's something that a lot of her fans have been very excited for this album to see what she has to say, because I have heard quite a lot how her personality on stage really shines and her fans are really endeared by her, really connected to her. And listening to that, I was really interested to hear what she had to say. And I was quite surprised by how there wasn't actually a whole lot said across these 14 tracks.
Yeah, who is writing the songs, I asked as we were starting into the review tonight, Dave. Obviously, that song used hugely and with great effect in Love Island. I think there's another track on here that was used in it. Is it one of the big TVs? The Anatomy of Dr.
Grey's Anatomy.
Grey's Anatomy, of course, yeah. The Anatomy of Dr. Grey. Grey's Anatomy was the name of the program.
Grey's Anatomy, yes, indeed.
Yeah, which is still...
Is it still going? Yeah.
Anyway, we're not reviewing that. who's writing the songs here?
It's a big pop album, so there's numerous people involved. Mm. To me, it's actually more interesting in who isn't writing the songs, because there's a reference here at one point in her career where she heard from David Guetta, the famous DJ. She heard from his camp, they reached out, and then I don't think it kind of came off. And then there's a track on this album which kind of refers to the imagined version of what might have happened there,
right.
All of which is to say that this is, I mean, she said herself, I read an interview that she did in 2020 where she said that her music is very syncable, and what that means is syncing it with licensing, with putting it into TV shows like the aforementioned Love Island and Grey's Anatomy. The first song she ever released was a track called Emerald back in 2016, and ended up on a Guinness ad. So she's very aware that she's making mass marketable commercial focused pop. That's the brief here, you know, like, I mean, and that's kind of what you get when you work with kind of either Scandinavian songwriters or songwriters who are looking to Scandinavia for that kind of tone. And that's kind of what you get in abundance on this record. I mean, like, as you have both noted, the name Lyra has been in the Irish music industry for quite some time. I too was surprised that this was only the debut coming out now. And she does have a big personality. She's very ebullient, shy and retiring. She is not.
Are you hearing it?
Not in these songs, no. Like, not at all. And I kept looking for it. I kept looking for identity. I wasn't finding it. I don't like doing the sound-alike thing, but I couldn't help but hear Sia in all of these tracks. I couldn't help but hear Selena Gomez in some of these tracks. And I kept wondering when Lyra would announce herself musically to me, and it just never actually happened.
A little bit of a listen to I'll Always Be the One. I'll Always Be the One there from Lyra and her self-titled debut album. We're all talking about the voice. We're all talking about, you know, her facility to put it out there, and I can see how she'd work in the big festival circuit as well. But there's something missing for both of you here. What's missing for you, Zara, as you give me your stars?
There's an apparent confidence and an apparent ambition in these songs because they're massive. Like, they are sonically, they're huge. And she fills the space so well. I think what a big issue here is that maybe there was too much time spent on this. It feels like it was very driven by pop trends of a couple of years ago. And I actually kind of want her to maybe find a niche for herself. Like, the song You on this album has a bit of a Celtic tinge. Maybe she could explore that a bit more and carve something different for herself, as opposed to us saying that she reminds us of other people. So for me, unfortunately, this was a 1.5.
That low?
Yeah.
1.5, even with that great voice?
Yeah, with the voice is kind of what got it the stars, because lyrically there was just very nothing there really.
Dave?
Yeah, I mean, the confidence is here to the point that this album closes with a cover of Edge of 17, which is something I wouldn't have done myself, especially after Miley Cyrus put a really unique twist on it and even recruited Stevie Nicks for a remix a few years ago. There's lyrics about, you know, sipping whiskey in the club, and I'm just like, can we please get away from this dance floor outdated trend thing? I really wanted to like this album, but I found myself just, I felt like hollow pop to me. It's 2 out of 5.
Whose is the hollow pop? Is it Lyra's or is it the production side of stuff?
I'd consider like maybe working with different people going down the road, because like you spent a long time. I think Zara's right. This took a long time in terms of gestation period, and I think the end result feels trapped in a different time period.
So you want to hear her?
She has so much talent. You know, she her personality is huge. You see it in interviews, and again, I'm sure in the live arena this works, but it just felt very rote to me in terms of an end product as a physical release of an album.
All right. Okay. That is your judgment on Lyra and her self-titled album. Let us move on to Maggie Rogers and her album, which is called Don't Forget Me. This is the title track. There we go. Don't Forget Me, title track from the new album from Maggie Rogers. Who are we talking about when we talk about Maggie Rogers if you have never seen Alaska? The viral video that Pharrell Williams was really responsible for in some ways, making it go viral.
Yeah, absolutely. And still to this day in interviews and reviews, that moment is not, she hasn't escaped that.
That moment being
when Pharrell Williams heard her song Alaska when she was an NYU student, and he was just completely enamoured, and really just showed how, how she has such an ear for crafting a hook.
Yeah.
Songwriting just seems so effortless to her, as we heard there on Don't Forget Me. From there she released 2 more studio albums, Grammy nominated, and became this huge figure. And actually it became the pressure of the stardom actually made her, she was diagnosed with chronic fatigue, she almost quit music. And in 2021, what I found quite interesting, she went to a graduate program in Harvard Divinity School to do a master's, which she's still working on, and her album Surrender from 2022 is part of her master's. The master's is about the spirituality of public gatherings and the ethics of power in pop culture. And I think with this album, it invigorated her approach to music. She worked with Ian Fitchuk, who's a big kind of Grammy winner with Kacey Musgraves, and they recorded this album in 5 sessions, and everything we hear is a first take.
That's kind of extraordinary. I mean, because it sounds like PR speak, 5 days, everything is a first take. If you can do that on the first take, you're pretty talented.
Yeah, she's very industrious. I interviewed her a few years ago and I was quite charmed by her. And I liked that debut album, heard it in a past life. I get the sense that maybe she didn't love it herself, because since then she's kind of gravitated away from those pop tropes. And you go back to some of those songs, the aforementioned Alaska, that's an all-timer. But by the time Surrender arrived in 2022, it was much more stripped back. It was self-produced. It was clearly a case of like maybe rejecting what could have been, you know, like instead of embracing that kind of pop now, which she has, I think she's getting more into that kind of Americana feel as you hear in that track. And you talk about PR details, she wrote an open letter when she announced this album, and if you look at some of the words from it, she wants to make an album with this that quote sounds like a Sunday afternoon, worn in denim, a drive in your favourite car, no makeup but the right amount of lipstick. I don't know what that means myself, but the Americana,
the right amount of lipstick, you don't know what that means.
I can never get it right.
Well, the wrong amount of lipstick is easy to spot
one of these days. But what we're getting here on this album, and like as Zara says, it's much more intimate, it's much more stripped back, it's much more first takey, it literally. In contrast to the album that we just talked about, this is someone finding their identity, and this is someone using their voice and kind of getting more comfortable with themselves. I don't know how arresting it is on the ear, but I applaud Maggie Rogers not just for staying in music but for finding her lane, truly.
Okay, stars?
3. It's pleasant. It does feel like a Sunday afternoon. And
so you do know what that means.
I know what that, we all know what that means. Yeah.
And denims, it's the lipstick bit. Okay. What are you saying overall, Zara? And can you enlighten Dave on the lipstick scenario?
I'll tell him afterwards. Yeah, it's a 3 for me as well. While I did really enjoy this, and I loved the country kind of infusion on the arrangements, out of the 3 most recent albums of hers, I felt it was the weakest, and I felt lyrically it kind of regurgitated some of the first album.
So, what'd you say? 3. 3, 2 threes. Right, finally then, Dublin-based psych krautrock quartet Melts with their second album, Field Theory. Dave, you were here back in 2022, in fact, reviewing their first album, Maelstrom. Have they grown since that?
They have, yeah. And I like that album. I gave it 3.5 out of 5 at the time. And I was very much, you know, my usual thing of like, can't wait to see what they do next. And they must have heard me because this album's come along pretty quickly. And it really kind of hits you from the off. There's so much momentum. I almost got their name mixed in there. My apologies. Lots of propulsive nature to this. It feels like a wall of noise. You know, it feels like kind of kraut rock. You mentioned psychedelic stuff. I mean, acts like The Horrors, a band that I love, a very underrated band, if you ask me. He's kind of all over this as well. It really, really takes you over. Like, this is not to be sat idle with, in contrast to the last album. It's a force of nature, and I really, really dig it.
Yeah, and they do big, long intros, it has to be said. So as you were talking, Dave, we were playing Figment Underneath You, which is the track that opens the album, and it gets going eventually with this. And that is a little section of the opening track from Field Theory from Mel's Figment. What are they singing about there, Zara?
It's interesting when you listen to it. Sometimes there is, because it's quite a big and it's very kind of, you know, synth-driven sound, and you almost expect it to be quite psychedelic in space kind of things they're talking about. But actually they said that they wanted to scale it back and talk about kind of interpersonal relationships and how the wider world informs their relationships thereafter. And listening to it intently, I was really surprised then to hear things like hissing of the stones, flicker of the sea, the stars are in there. So it takes us down to earth. But then later on we hear Own Kenny, you know, say things like, all my stories have gone stale, sooner or later things will get better. So there is a lot of kind of self-reflection in there as well, which I think is one of the elements to this music. Like, it's so propulsive and it's so energetic, and part of that is as well, they recorded this to tape and played it live with Daniel Fox of Gillaband, who produced it, and that has really captured the live essence to it. But it's so textured and there's so much of it that it keeps you wanting more and coming back.
But you, obviously you have to go back to it, because I was asking him a rather leading question when I said, what are the singing about that? Because the lyrics and the vocals are so far back in the mix, you really have to work hard to hear what's been said, Dave.
Which I quite love, actually. I like having to work for that in the sense, I think it's a smart decision. I think that their relationship with the aforementioned Dan Fox of Gillaband, who produced the previous record as well, it's so fruitful. Like, this thing sounds massive, all-encompassing, it sounds gorgeous. You heard it there, like when you played that clip. It's just, it attacks you, but it also invites you in. Like, it's spacious, yet it's trapping. There's all kinds of contradictions at play here, but I liked having to go back to it and kind of get more from it each time. It wasn't just a one listen and I'm done. There's more to this. Like, there is substance here, and there is a growing confidence with this band as well.
A listen to the beginning of Waves of Wonder. There we go, Waves of Wonder, just the opening section of it from Melts and their new album, Field Theory. We were saying as we were listening to that, this would be a great band to see live. Does the live energy, does it transfer to the album? Did the album work overall for you, Zara, and Stars?
I think certainly it transferred, especially with how they recorded it. They recorded it live, and I do feel that, like, I got really swept up in this and I couldn't stop bouncing around in my chair whenever I listened to it. So I think that was a great sign for me, and they did capture that.
Stars?
And Stars, for me, it was a 4.
And what are you saying overall, Dave?
It's a 4 for me as well. I think it's great. I love the new romantic sheen kind of, and the propulsive almost techno elements to it as well. They're a band to keep an eye on, and definitely both ears on.
Both ears on. Dave Hanratty and Zara Hedeman. 4 stars for Field Theory from Melts. Before that, we were speaking about Don't Forget Me by Maggie Rogers and Lyra's self-titled debut album. That is our lot for this Friday evening here on Arena. Niall Fitzmaurice and Liam Murphy researched. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy.